want all of you to know, I, Dennis Prager, pay my own money to be a member of the Daily Wire. I did not want a free subscription. I think you should support the things that are good. And he is giving what PragerU has every year, a commencement address. After all, we call ourselves a university. We fully acknowledge we're not an accredited university, but we teach a lot. So we have an annual commencement address. This year, Ben Shapiro gives it. So, Ben, what is the topic?
The topic is how to fight back against the institutional authoritarian left that you are undoubtedly going to experience after you leave college. I think a lot of people exit college and they have the sort of conservative idea that the real world is going to knock some sense into everybody else and you don't have to go through the sort of authoritarian nonsense you went through while you were at university. And unfortunately, that is just not the case anymore. All of the same authoritarians you had to deal with in a classroom now are your bosses at the corporations you're about to enter. And so the commencement address is about the challenges you're likely to face in the work world, which, frankly, look very similar to the challenges you face when you're in university.
And what should they do about it? What's your advice?
I think the first thing they have to do is get organized. You have to find allies. You have to treat the renormalization of American institutions as a threat that it is. And what that means is that a small group of very stubborn people can make a very large difference at a company. Saying no is a really, really important thing. And having a bunch of friends who will say no with you is an even more important thing. So just as the left likes to think institutionally by taking a kind of small, intransigent core of people and then insisting that everybody bow to them, everybody mimic their whims, you can do that in reverse. If your company is cramming down critical race theory on you, you're fully within your rights to, number one, go get a lawyer and sue them for violation of the Civil Rights Act, but number two, you can find enough people inside your company probably, if it's large enough or depending where you are, to side with you. And if there is a, and if you guys sign a letter to the bosses saying, listen, we are just not going to do your critical race theory training. We're not going to do this form of diversity training. Either fire all of us or fire none of us. Corporations tend to back down. Corporations are really risk averse. They do not like litigation. They do not like controversy. And the goal of conservatives at this point should not be to make corporations overtly conservative again. Maybe that's, you know, in the future, but to actually just reestablish the possibility of openness in a lot of these corporations and a lot of the workplaces that no longer exist.
Talking about the corporations, what do you think drives them to make these woke statements, these hate America statements, hate white statements? Is it cowardice? Is it young employees who are pushing them? What do you think it is?
So it's all of the above, and it depends which group you're talking about. If you're talking about the people at the head of the corporations, it's risk aversion. Corporations are not known for being particularly risk-seeking because, again, they're profit-seeking and profit-maximizing, and they don't want to take risks that they don't have to take in their pursuit of profit in a particular sphere. What the left has done is they've created a really perverse incentive structure where if you say something that violates the tenets of the woke, they will activate on social media, they will activate all of their friends and family to attack you on social media, and the typical risk-averse move is to immediately cave to that sort of pressure. Okay, so we issue a statement, what's the big deal? Okay, so we send a letter to our employees, what's the big deal? It gets everybody off our back, and we can go about our daily business. Well, the problem is, soon you have the woke basically running the place, right? This has happened everywhere from the New York Times to Coca-Cola, apparently. You have a small coterie of people who've been able to use the risk aversion of corporate bosses against them, and that means that these corporate bosses are scared. The other thing that's happened is because of the complete rewriting of American law in the wake of the 1960s Civil Rights Act, some of which was very good, but some of which went too far in terms of violations of individual rights, there's a lot of legal risk aversion that takes place as well, and there's this idea that if we train you in diversity training, if we hire Robin DiAngelo or Imran Kennedy to give a lecture for $20,000 a pop, then we've insulated ourselves from possible liability because if somebody sues you for discrimination, you say, well, hey, we have diversity training. I don't know what you want from us. Right? We have individual employees who do this stuff, but we certainly didn't create a climate of racial intolerance. And so there's a legal risk aversion. There's a market risk aversion. There are studies that show, by the way, that if corporations are liberal, then the crowd tends to react to them not at all. People aren't typically bothered by it. They don't care. If corporations are apolitical, people don't tend to react particularly strongly to it. If a corporation is identified in any way as conservative, it immediately loses 30 points in popularity, all from the left, deciding the corporation is evil because it's in any way conservative.
So why do they pay a price? If half the country is conservative, why do they only pay a price being conservative and never leftist?
Because the right wing doesn't think institutionally, number one. We tend to think individually. So our idea is, okay, well, if I don't like a product, I won't buy the product. But for the left, that's not the way this works. For them, it's if I don't like a company, not only will I not buy their product. I will tell all my friends not to buy their product. I will wallop them in public. I will try and destroy the people who are at the head of the institution. I will shame them publicly. It's important to take over the institution. That's one thing. The other thing is that the right tends to separate off, I think, in a very healthy way, the product that they are buying from the ideology of the people who are making
right.
it.
I've always done that.
That's a good idea, right? Because if you want to have open markets, you really shouldn't have to check the ideology of your plumber before you hire a plumber. You shouldn't really have to check the ideology of the person who runs Coke before you buy a can of Coke. But the left doesn't think that way. The left has decided that it is a sign of moral virtue to shop based on ideology. Just as they said in the 1960s that the personal is the political, they've now extended that to say that any product you buy is personal, which is political.
Right. So I want to remind everybody, Ben Shapiro gives this year's commencement address at PragerU. In 10 seconds, what do you think of living in Florida after a life in California?
I mean, it's an actual free state. I mean, honestly, if you've lived an entire life in California and you arrive in Florida, it feels like a different country. I mean, there's a different level of liberty, but put aside the tax rate. I mean, the fact is that this state was open last June, and it shows. I mean, there's just a more relaxed feel. There's a feeling of more tolerance for people around you. It's a really diverse state.
Well, bless you. Ben Shapiro, thank you, my friend.
Joining me now, Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House and Fox News contributor. He's the author of Trump and the American Future. It's always great to speak to you, Speaker Gingrich, someone I consider a mentor and who, as you can see, I've been following around since I was 13 years old.
Oh, my God.
Do you remember that?
I don't think I'd ever seen that before.
Yes.
Oh, that's amazing.
I want to talk to you about this goal that we have in this country of getting back to doing great things. And as you know, I feel like this is something that really ought to unite us. It ought to bring us together. It ought to inspire us each as Americans. What can we do to get back to that point?
Well, you know, one of the greatnesses of the American system is that government is, in the end, not at the center of our being. We're not the Soviet Union. We're not communist China. We're not Cuba. We are, despite every effort of the left, we are still a free people, and you can see that in space. Mm-hmm. The greatest breakthroughs in space right now are coming from two or three entrepreneurs, and they're just doing it. In fact, unless the Biden administration finds a way to cripple them, they're almost certainly going to take us to the moon, and they're almost certainly going to take us to Mars, and you're going to find your family having the option, I think, by the time that they are 20, 25 years old to be able to consider seriously going to Mars. Mm-hmm. Now, these are not small things. And it's taken, it's ironic for people who sometimes complain about immigration. Elon Musk is one of the great contributors to America's future. And he does it because it fills his ego needs. He didn't fill out a form for the government. The government has funded some of his projects. But he's undertaken things nobody thought possible. I also think that we have to look at, if you wanted a really great goal for America, it would be to decide that every American was truly going to have the ability to pursue happiness. And that would require overhauling the schools. It would require providing physical safety in our biggest cities. It would require changing the tax law to make it very easy to run a small business. But if we took it seriously, rolled up our sleeves, my guess is within a decade, we would be a dramatically different country than we are right now.
Speaker, I feel like we need to be on more of a Cold War footing when it comes to our relationship with China. They have undertaken a war against us in terms of sending fentanyl over that has killed so many Americans. We see their support in Alaska of the type of race-based politics that are designed to split us apart internally. What can we do to achieve more of a Cold War mindset about our relationship with China in a time when so many people seem to be compromised by it at the highest levels of corporate America and of government?
Well, we're right now exactly where we were between 1945 and 1945. Out of World War II, we didn't want to have a Cold War. We didn't want to have the Soviet Union as an adversary, but they gave us no choice. And over time, we gradually toughened up. We gradually created institutions to contain them. Now, I'll give you a very simple example. A bill has been introduced to allow people to sue China over COVID. But of course, everyone knows even if you won the lawsuit, they wouldn't pay anything. We should establish a 30% tariff on all Chinese goods so that we could build a trust fund and pay off the enormous debt that China owes the United States. And I'd recommend every country in the world impose a 30% tariff, because the truth is the Chinese caused what was the Chinese virus. Trump was right. All this political correctness is nonsense. The Chinese lied to and manipulated the World Health Organization. The Chinese bear the responsibility for allowing this virus to get out of control. And they say they have to be real things. This is not about words. Mm-hmm. When we were faced with the Soviet Union, we built the Strategic Air Command, the Central Intelligence Agency. We created the modern Air Force. We created NATO to protect Europe, CETO to protect Southeast Asia. We were deeply engaged in real things. And Xi Jinping's not stupid. Until we do real things that have a real impact, he's just going to think it's just a bunch of politicians over here prattling, and he'll figure that he can influence most of them and own a few of them.
Mm-hmm. I think, Mr. Speaker, that we have a situation now where, unfortunately, we have so many politicians who are asleep at the wheel on this and are not paying attention to how important it is for the future of the country. Thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Hey, Sean Hannity here. Hey, click here to subscribe to Fox News YouTube page and catch our hottest interviews and most compelling analysis. You will not get it anywhere else.
His latest is to produce this film, The Streets Were My Father. And again, my friends, fatherlessness is the greatest contributor to crime, and God is the greatest solution. And if you're an atheist, you should be as firmly on board as any religious person, because the issue isn't whether or not you have faith, it's whether or not you acknowledge truth. Even if you think God is a magical potion, let us say somebody developed a magical potion and it solved most people's worst problems, addiction of any type, and violence. Let's say it did. Wouldn't you advocate taking the magical potion? So you were saying, Lee Habib, that just as the church is led in the anti-abolition, in the pro-abolition, anti-slavery movement, they should lead in, and then I had to cut you off for a break. Go ahead.
Indeed. Look, it's up to us, and we can complain, but we're not complainers. I mean, we're doers. And the American church needs to grow, and it needs to grow by radical acts of love. And when people see those radical acts of love, and you'll see them in this film, you'll see radical acts of love so beautiful. A father forgiving the guy who killed his son and telling that guy he's his son because he knew that kid never had a father, the kid who shot his own son. And when you see radical acts of love and godliness, it makes you want to be godly. It makes you want to think about God. And it is an answer to your problem. And faith has always been the bulwark of American liberty. Liberty without faith is licentiousness. And the abolition movement, the civil rights movement, was led not just by Dr. Martin Luther King, but remember, he was Reverend King, and his daddy was a pastor. That civil rights movement was led by the cross and led by great Jewish and Christian religious leaders fighting for real justice, God's justice, not social justice, God's justice. And they're very different. They're very different things.
Powerful stuff. It's interesting. It's a separate discussion for another time. If my child were murdered, would I embrace his murderer? I don't think I'd have that in me. But it doesn't mean anything. I'm just being open with you.
I would say this, Dennis. The alternative is to be consumed by bitterness. And then you let the person who murdered your son own you.
Yeah.
And in this respect, it's not that you're forgiving him, but that you're letting go of it yourself. And it's very powerful for you and for that and for that.
In any event, I'm just emoting with you. But the your message, the message is truly of overwhelming significance, and this is the type of film we need. So it is now available at salemnow.com. Is that correct?
That's correct, and I'm hoping particularly people of faith. This is a great proselytizing tool. We need people to join our churches. And if you simply hand this disc, buy some discs, and hand them to people without fathers, hand them to strangers who may not believe in the power of God. And it's not going to be you proselytizing or you testifying. It's going to be these three men, and they're weeping in this film. And these are tough men, and these are gangsters and murderers, but they're human beings. And there was a reason that they became the way they became. And you'll find that out, and you'll discover the power of God to transform a life. And by buying this at salemnow.com, buy a few discs, buy 10, hand them out to people through the year. And you'll get a thank you from those people, I promise you. You'll get a thank you.
I agree. Keep up the great work, Lee Habib.
And thank you for all the great work you do, Dennis.
Hello, everybody. I'm Dennis Prager. Welcome to Hour 3 of my show. President of the United States gave the most anti-American speech in the history of the American presidency yesterday. I loathe Joe Biden as much as any of you never-Trumpers loathed Donald Trump, just for the record. But I don't have a Biden derangement syndrome, and I am not obsessed with it. And it is not the only issue in America. And in any event, if Biden were not president, Kamala Harris would be president, and nothing would change. In fact, nothing would change with any Democrat. Democratic Party loathes this country at this time, and they are proud of it. And if you don't loathe the country, if you don't consider it systemically racist, vile, born in sin, filled with white supremacists as the great enemy of the country, then you are not a functional Democrat. It's become a despicable party, and it may crush the country. The country is hanging in the balance. Biden is ruining it financially, militarily, and morally. I can't think of a good thing that he has done. Yeah, I'm sure he has, but I can't think of any. But I just want people to understand that it is possible for sincere Americans to loathe Joe Biden as much as sincere people loathed President Trump. The narcissism of the left is that their hatreds are unique. That's because we act more decently and don't get hysterical over it. But here's a proof. The speech was disgusting. It was, if this had been given 20 years ago, the person would not have been considered eligible for dog catcher in the Democratic Party. You can't imagine Jimmy Carter giving the speech. You can't imagine, see who were our recent Democratic president. I couldn't imagine Barack Obama giving the speech. This is how much the left has gained power in the party. I don't think Barack Obama disagrees with a word, but he wouldn't have given this speech. Bill Clinton certainly wouldn't have given this speech. All right, let's see. This is yesterday's, folks. This is the Arlington. No, it's not Arlington that we're talking about. Right, so I'm just commenting on what I have here. There we go. All right. Let's begin here, then, with the first Biden clip here.
Young black entrepreneurs are just as capable of succeeding, given the chance, as white entrepreneurs are, but they don't have lawyers, they don't have accountants, but they have great ideas. Does anyone doubt this whole nation be better off? from the investments those people make. And I promise you, that's why I set up this National Small Business Administration that's much broader, because they're going to get those loans.
It's hard to understand, but I guess the gist of it is that there would be far more black entrepreneurs if the country weren't racist. They can't get lawyers.
But they don't have lawyers. They right. don't there have. They, okay. They don't have accountants.
What's he talking about?
I don't know what he's talking about. Okay, just that. That's it. There is. The left has created the scenario that if you're black, you're, with rare exceptions, you are a victim. And all that does is engender hatred. There are no happy people on earth who think they're victims. I have a chapter on victim thinking in a book written that I wrote in 1998, 23 years ago. And it says that had nothing to do with what we're going through right now. If you think you're a victim, you cannot be happy. It is one of the worst possible self-images, because people who think they're victims are not only intrinsically unhappy, there are no happy victims, but you are also embittered to the point that normal moral rules rarely apply to you. I am a victim, I may therefore lash out. And that is what the left is doing to many people of color. You have permission to lash out at the scumbag society you are stuck in. That millions of black Africans have moved to the United States voluntarily is one of the great proofs of the lie of how systemically racist this is. I've always asked, never gotten an answer to this, are black Africans stupid? Were any Jews moving to Germany in the 1930s? Not that I know of, because Germany really was anti-Semitic. But America is not really anti-black. That's why millions of blacks move here. They're not stupid. They're not masochists. It is the greatest lie since the Jewish blood libel of the Middle Ages that Jews killed Christian children to get their blood to bake matzah on Passover. That was a huge lie, libel, and is the biggest national libel in history. The entire population of Jews in England was expelled. They were kicked out of England, largely on this charge. And many Jews were tortured to death on this charge. Communities were wiped out. The second biggest national libel in history is that America's racist. Joe Biden is a libeler. It is. Who was it who said to me, yes, Rod Dreher yesterday at the Ultimate Issues Hour, said these are not just lies, they're anti-truths. It's like a higher level of lie. And that you still don't get what he said?
I don't get their businesses fail because they can't.
Their businesses fail because they can't afford a lawyer or accountant. Okay, that's right. He said the data shows. I'd like to see where the data is. And how do you have data on that? Is there data on how many people don't get accountants?
Well, businesses fail because they don't have accountants.
Yes, businesses fail because they don't get accountants. That's correct. My father was an accountant, and I have warm feeling toward them. Next, please.
I'd be a little part of it. But you know what, Rev? I didn't realize hate's never defeated. It only hides. It hides.
Tell the truth.
And given a little bit of oxygen, just a little bit of oxygen by his leaders, it comes out of there from under the rock like it was happening again, as if it never went away. And so, folks, we can't. We must not give hate a safe harbor. As I said in my address at the joint session of Congress, according to
the guy is spouting hate, and we can't. The left is the hate center of the universe, certainly of America. And they can't. I mean, it's truly Soviet. it's the what they are guilty of that they charge others. And the others are always invisible. Where is this hate under the rock? How come we don't recognize it? I guess because we're haters? Really? And who gave the oxygen? Of course, Donald Trump. Donald Trump gave hate the oxygen. Really? Well, it's part of the Charlottesville lie that he said that they were good Nazis. Oh, does he repeat that again? Yeah. It's a gigantic lie. He never said they were good Nazis. We have an entire video on that. Steve Cortez gives it. And you should watch it. It's PragerU, 5 minutes. It's, if that doesn't prove to you that it's a gigantic lie that he called Nazis good people, then nothing will. Oh, God. The left foments hatred. That's the irony. This country is basically such a decent place to live in for every color. And they have made it a bad place. They have truly ruined it. Whether it's the ruining of by the left and the Bidens, the Biden Harris Schumer Pelosi left, and the New York Times, if they have permanently ruined it, I don't know. I do know that this is the tipping point where we have to fight back. Those of you who fight the bringing in of the 1619 curriculum into your children's school, you have to fight it, and if you lose, you take your children out of the school.
The Dennis Prager Show.
Politicians have elected their own voters. They've driven out the people who couldn't stand the taxes, the crime, the corruption, and you're left with people who can tolerate it. And the people who can tolerate it aren't necessarily going to be voting in a law and order technocrat anytime soon.
Does the average New Yorker know how the murder rate has increased?
I think so. Yes, it's hard to miss. I mean, the murder rate has gone up. I mean, the murder rate is pretty much isolated into certain, you know, high crime areas. But certainly people know that street crime is up, that homelessness and drug addicts are homeless and drug addicts are definitely more emboldened. You see this all over the place, people stealing from drug stores, general street violence is up, and a general sense of chaos and disorder has descended upon the city. And this is all by design, really, by the removal, the steady removal and alienation of the police from doing their job, which they had done quite well. This was all built, put into place by the progressive ascendancy, as I call it, of which Bill de Blasio is fruit, flower, and fragrance. So this was like 10 years in the making, at least.
So does the average New Yorker, now that you tell me that the average New Yorker is aware of the increase in violent crime, if I ask the average New Yorker, do you hold Bill de Blasio in any way or in any important way responsible for this, what would the answer be?
Well, I think a lot of people, if they were honest, would say, yeah, he hasn't done a great job. At the same time, there are people who are going to say, oh, no, it's because of structural inequalities and poverty and, you know, the usual liberal balderdash we've been hearing since the 60s about root causes and, you know, the lack of opportunity. But I think if people were honest, they would have to, say, sure, Bill de Blasio and the movement that he represents has responsibility for this.
But it won't affect their their voting. Forgive me one second. It won't affect their voting. They'll still vote Democrat.
Sure. Oh, yeah. They'll absolutely vote Democrat. I do believe that in the last year, people have woken up a bit to street disorder. And in the current primary campaign for the Democratic nomination, the candidates who are at least voicing a more sensible approach to law and order are at the top. I'm not saying that they're perfect, but they're not, you know, the people who really want to abolish prisons, dismantle the police, they're not polling very well. People are waking up to this. Of course, you know, it doesn't take that many votes to win an election in New York City, so... But the people who are paying attention, I think, are kind of waking up a little bit. But the problem is, you know, as we know, you can have everybody vote one way. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to change the structure of things. The liberal, the progressives, they have control of the city and its institutions. And wresting it away from them is not going to be as easy as just one election.
That's a good point. What is the?
I mean, we saw this at the federal level in 2016. You know,
yes, no,
you
it's
can
a,
win
right.
an election. It
yes, but
mean
the bureaucracy gonna, remains. That know. Is exactly right. So,
right.
What is the attrition rate in the New York City Police Department?
You know, that's a very good question. I don't have that now. It's not as bad as it's been in some cities like Portland. Mm-hmm. And Seattle and Minneapolis, where people are just fleeing. We haven't seen, you know, de Blasio has managed the police department, and he's never completely turned his back on them in the same way that some of these other mayors did. And I think they're adding people. They are adding people. I mean, New York City still has a fair amount of money to hire police officers, and it's a pretty good job generally. But yeah, I definitely think retirements are up. We're not at a crisis point yet in terms of staffing. And
all
it's
right.
A very large department.
Yeah.
So, you know, they...
All right. We're going to do a part two, but I want to remind everybody, look, anything that Heather McDonald writes the foreword to is obviously important. It's an important book, my friends. Seth Baron, The Last Days of New York, A Reporter's True Tale. It is up at DennisPrager.com. And I will have you back. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We return in a moment. Yeah, I believe that. A lot of people are not finding people to work. That is correct. So what do you think about the virus having been made in a lab? And how do you explain this government's hands-off policy with regard to China? Oh, they're still absolutely angry at Russia and Putin by name. But China? If you think clearly, do you not believe China is a greater threat to the United States in any dimension than is Russia? Something you should know about China that many people do not know. The Chinese regard themselves as special. Now, by the way, so do Americans. A lot of groups do. I don't see, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying it as a critique, but I want you to know that it's true. The word for China in Chinese is middle or center kingdom. China should be the center of the world is the view of many Chinese, including the Chinese Communist Party. And with America having a president who craps on his own country, versus a Chinese dictator who constantly speaks of the greatness of his country, guess who's more likely to win that battle? leaders who crap on their country, who have contempt for it, a party in power which can only speak about its country's rot, its moral rot, its decay, its worthlessness, or a country that speaks about its greatness. Now, I believe there is a middle road. There is nothing wrong in acknowledging the Tulsa massacre that took place exactly 100 years ago. That is part of American history. It's a rotten part. But every country had such rot. The uniqueness of America is not what it did bad. The uniqueness of America is what it did good. Nobody else did as much good as this country. Resolved to be happy. I was about a junior in high school. It's very easy to be unhappy, and don't take the easy way out. I combined the two. It was a good moment. Takes no effort to be unhappy. That's the default position for many people. Right? Life is work. When you know that, you're halfway there. Whatever it is you want, you got to work at, including happiness. That's why I have a happiness hour. Today's subject is a biggie. Most of them are biggies. I never said I had a smallie for a topic. And that is, why are so many young people unhappy? Now, I've addressed this in passing, but now I'm going to devote an hour to it. There are micro and macro answers to the question of why are there so many unhappy young people? I mean, college age in particular. Everybody knows a moody teenager. The moody teenagers are a dime a dozen. But why, even getting into college, why are there so many unhappy? I'm going to offer you some responses, and then I want to hear you both react to mine and give me yours. But here's something that I have been thinking about for, I don't know why, but I've been thinking about in the recent past that I do believe has been a contributor. And it's not the number one, even though it's the first one I'm mentioning it. It's only because it's in the micro, and I want to start with the micro reason. I think a lot of parents made a big mistake in not wanting to be their children's parents, but their pals. And I don't think that contributes to a child's happiness. A child wants a parent because parents, as opposed to pals, give security. And they give you something to aim for. A parent as a model is a very powerful force in a child's life. Where else are they going to get these models? I mean, they do. You can get them on TV. You can get them anywhere, theoretically. But the most logical area to find a model is in a parent. But this notion of I want to be my child's friend when they're 8, if you want to be your child's friend when the child is 40, that's a separate issue. But when the child is 8, they can have a lot of pals, but they only get one crack at parents or two cracks at parents. And I think that does, in fact, add to a child's happiness over the long term, having parents who have played a parental role in their lives. The power of parents in people's lives is really staggering when you think about it. You know, Bernie Madoff just died a couple of weeks ago. one of his adult children committed suicide. And it is not uncommon among disgraced parents that a child will become profoundly depressed and even commit suicide. You don't want your parents to be shameful. It's bad if your child does bad things, but it doesn't have the same devastating effect as a parent doing bad things. The foundations of your life are not rocked by a bad child as they are by a bad parent. The power of parents is really, it's almost unfair, because you're very lucky. Nobody gets perfect parents, by the way. It's why I find a lot of complaining about parents to be immature. We'll see how you do as a parent. Then, by the way, it's one of the reasons I'm convinced parents love when their kids have kids, because they're far more accepting of the parents. One of the most common sentiments that a new parent has is, my parents did all this for me? After you get up, 3 a.m. for 3 months for a crying child and change a diaper at 4 a.m., yeah, wow, my parents must have done that for me. I remember when I was a parent thinking one day, wow, I really should be grateful for my parents that I have all my limbs. Just for that. That somehow they protected me from, they were able to protect me from permanent injury. So, it's the role of the parent is a huge one. Here's another factor, I believe, in the unhappiness of many children. They have nothing to live for. Nothing. Nothing fills their lives with meaning. The poisonous, destructive, nihilistic left has ensured that their lives have been emptied of all that is good and meaningful: religion, love of country, marriage, family. Happiness Hour, Dennis Prager Show. We continue.